This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most popular person to emerge from public radio in its short history is Garrison Keillor. He's made an important contribution to American humor with a style that is both down-home and literary. And his fictional Lake Wobegon has become a reference point when Americans talk about a certain kind of small town. I guess it's only fitting that someone who's added so much to radio should devote his first novel to the early days of the medium. Keillor's new novel is called WLT, A Radio Romance. This isn't Keillor's first book. He's had several bestsellers, but they've been books of short stories and a history of Lake Wobegon. As you probably know, Keillor lives in Manhattan now, where he hosts the show The American Radio Company. We invited him to read from his new novel, and after the reading, we'll talk about his experiences writing it.
Back in the spring of 1926 in Minneapolis, two brothers who have a failing sandwich restaurant, Ray and Roy Soderbergh, start up a radio station, WLT, which stands for With Lettuce and Tomato, with the idea of promoting their establishment. They come into radio backwards and hire a bunch of friends and people they run into to do the shows who don't know what it's all about either. Even the WLT regulars considered the idea of broadcasting pretty amazing. They could not quite believe it. They never got used to it. To think that their voices were heard by thousands of people all over Minnesota. Leo LaValle would tell his wife Leola in the evening about a joke he told on the radio that day. "You should have heard it," he'd say. "I did hear it as clear as day," she'd tell him. And of course, Leo knew this, and yet never having heard the radio himself, he couldn't be sure. One day, unable to bear the mystery, he backed away from the microphone as he was telling a story about Ole Torvaldsen's horse. Ole got drunk one night, and his friends turned the saddle backwards on his faithful horse, Henrik, and Ole climbed on board and rode away home to Lena and burst in the door weeping. As he told this joke, Leo edged toward the studio door to the linen closet with the microphone in hand, and he cracked open the studio door just as he came to the punchline, where Ole said, "They cut Henrik's head off, but I stuck my finger in his windpipe, and he ran faster than ever," and recognized his own voice on the control room monitor and cried out, "I have heard it." Sensing that the home audience might not grasp the meaning of his remark, he quickly added, "I am on the radio." By June, the broadcast schedule reached 6 hours daily, and by November, they were up to 12, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Mornings were Organ Reflections with Patrice Duval Paulson, The Rise and Shine Show with Buddy and Bob and the Lonesome Ramblers, Dad Benson's Almanac, Elsie and Johnny, Adventures in Homemaking, Current Events with Ray's wife Vesta, who returned in the afternoon with the Poetry Corner, Morning Musicale, Scripture Nuggets with the voice of the Reverend Irving James Knox. "May the good Lord hold you in his loving hands and keep you until we meet again. And remember, keep looking up, friends." The Classroom of the Air, and Let's Sing with the Hamburg Quartet. "It's the one, it's the one, it's the one with the fun in the bun. When you eat a hamburg, you always clamor for just another doggone one." And Today's Good Citizen and Your Health and Hygiene with Dr. Dan Jensen, discussing measles or back pain or blood in the urine, followed by In Memoriam. As we make our earthly journey, let us take some time each day to remember friends and neighbors who have helped along the way. And the Noontime Jubilee with Leo LaValle and his dreadful jokes, and all of those amateur acts, Miss Stephanie and her all-boy Otto Hart band, and Lance and Marilyn, the Sweethearts of Song, and the Jolly Chums, and Little Catherine under Court of Canaries, and Ray's Uncle Albert reciting Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, The Village Smithy Stands, and one day they even had a dog named Freckles singing Indian Love Call. And there was Avis Burnett, small town librarian, a show with actors starring Marcia Rowles as the ever-patient Avis, the woman who sacrifices her own happiness in the service of others. Radio leaped the miles and came to every home with a bounty of cheerful information. "What a boon," said Roy Soderbergh. "Radio was the remedy for isolation, which was the curse of the farmer. Now he had a friendly neighbor to sit down with at any hour of the day and tell him interesting things." Roy set up a farm bureau, and sign-on crept forward to 6 a.m. and then 5, for the farm hour, and he plumped for a late sign-off, but Ray opposed broadcasting at night, and even after he gave in and WLT stayed on the air until 8:30 and then 10 p.m., he was dead set against a Saturday night barn dance show. Saturday night was a family's one night together, and radio shouldn't go barging in and spoil it.
That's Garrison Keillor reading from his new novel, WLT, A Radio Romance. Did the initial idea for the novel, Garrison, encompass this kind of history of radio before the days of TV? Or up until the days of TV, I should say.
Yes, I loved those old radio shows that came before the time that I remember. I grew up in Minnesota listening to the very tail end of that era of radio, when people still wrote scripts and performed them on the air, and when musicians performed in the studio for a radio audience. And what you hear as a child, you never quite lose your fascination with.
What were some of the shows that you remember? Were they anything like the list of shows that you've just read us?
There was a noontime show back in Minneapolis called Good Neighbor Time with Bob DeHaven and Wally Olson and his band, and they had a whole cast of regulars who were on every day and sang, Jeannie Arlen, and they had a cowboy trio, I forget their names, the Red River Valley Boys, I think, and a tenor, and genial Bob DeHaven, who did commercials for Oxydol and interviewed the friends and neighbors who sat in the studio and listened to the show. I listened to it at home, and then I saw it in downtown Minneapolis. I went to the studios to see the show when my mother sent me down to go to swimming lessons at the YMCA. I snuck away from the YMCA because I was afraid of water and went down and watched the radio show. Always terrified that Bob DeHaven would interview me and then my mother, who was listening at home, would find out.
Did that ever happen?
No, Bob never came close to me. I was just a little kid sitting in the back corner of the studio. But I remember being fascinated by it, the big control room window and men in the dark back there waving their arms, and the announcer who had this look of exquisite boredom on his face until the one moment when he's supposed to come up and back announce somebody's song. And then he was all personality for about 15 seconds. And then he sank back into lethargy.
Now, when did you start writing WLT?
This story started out as a story for the New Yorker magazine called WLT, The Edgar Era, which was published, I think, early 70s, 71, 72. And I got interested in that radio station, and I wrote some more stories for the New Yorker about it and one for the Atlantic called The Tip Top Club, and always meant to write a novel about it. Started one. It failed of its own weight because I disliked the narrator so much. I just got tired of him. He's such a bore. He just wouldn't go away. And so I put it aside, wrote Lake Wobegon Days, and then I resumed with the WLT novel about a year and a half ago. And it came rather quickly. Once I threw out most of it, the rest of it quickly spread, and it made a regulation weight novel, almost a pound, I think. I'm not sure.
401 pages.
How much does that weigh? How much does 401 pages weigh?
Less than Norman Mailer's book, I can tell you that. Were there a requisite number of pages you felt you had to have before you could really call it a bona fide novel?
I felt that it should have a certain heft in the reader's hand, that you shouldn't, if you were to be seen reading a novel in public, you don't want it to be too thin, or people will think that you're incapable of something more ambitious. So I'm looking out for my reader's self-respect here. This is a decent This is a decent-sized book. People look at you reading it, they'll know you're literate.
What does it mean to you to have finished a novel?
Well, it feels to me as if I've performed a useful service and provided something that gives people enjoyment. That was my reason for doing it. I think, like Woebegone Days, was to express myself and to say where I come from, which is another purpose that a writer has, of course, is to defend his or her background and his or her people and say where you're from and who you are and what makes you different from other people. So I did that in Lake Woebegone Days, which was my other long book. And having done that and served my own purposes, now I've tried to write a book which is amusing. I was not brought up to be an amusing writer, you understand. I was brought up by serious people with a high moral purpose, and so I'm sort of escaping from it in this book. Its only purpose is to make somebody laugh.
Well, did novels play a part at all in the lives of these serious people with high-minded purpose anyways?
No, they were church people.
Yeah.
They didn't read novels. Never. We didn't have one novel in our home. I think that's kids. We kids in our family, we had Christian novels. They were novels about like the Sugar Creek Gang series. You probably didn't read that.
No.
These were Christian boys, and they all had wonderful times together. And then there was always...
Having good, clean fun.
That's right, good, clean fun. And then another boy moved into the neighborhood, and he was not saved. And in the course of the novel, he was saved, and he came to church. And every novel was like that.
Did you like these?
Yeah, I sort of liked them, okay. You know. It was all we had.
Right. When did you start going off to the town library and finding other things?
Oh, that was amazing to find other things, including the things on the high shelves. One of the novelists whom I enjoyed the most early on was Sinclair Lewis, who wrote satirically about the Midwest and about small towns. Main Street and Babbitt were two of my favorite books of his. I liked Lewis a lot when I was a kid because he made fun of the people who were around me. And I hope that this book has some of his satiric wit in it.
Garrison Keillor is my guest, and he has a new novel called WLT, A Radio Romance. We'll talk more, but first we'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Garrison Keillor is with us. He has a new novel called WLT. I remember you saying a while back that you really liked to work with a small canvas. That's certainly not what you get to do with a novel. In a novel like this, there's a lot of characters. There's several decades that elapse. What did you enjoy most and find most frustrating about working with that kind of span?
I enjoyed the crowd of characters that came through here, and I enjoyed naming them. Characters like Leo LaValle and Luella Wells, who does the Adventures in Homemaking show and gives the recipes for oatmeal cookies and tells how to get cranberry juice stains out of an Angora sweater and the like. I enjoyed creating these characters and naming them and having them parade through, sort of like War and Peace, except they speak English and they're not moody. But the thing that was frustrating is that if all of these characters move through all of these decades in Minneapolis from 1926 through the early 50s, and then the epilogue is in the present time, you have to keep the dates squared away, and the characters have to follow a certain logic. And logic is not my strong suit, nor is consistency. So I've had to pore over this thing and make sure that if he was 12 years old in 1937, then he can't be in his early 40s in 1938, right?
Right. Right.
Okay. That's a problem for some of us who were not good at math.
Do you remember, Garrison, the very first time you were on the air?
Yes, I think that I do. I can remember the first time that I thought that I was on the air. It was a closed-circuit student radio station at the University of Minnesota called WMMR. I was in the student union up on the third floor, and I went in, and I did a newscast. It was at 12 o'clock. It was a 15-minute newscast. I carefully edited this newscast myself and had, as it turned out, about an hour and a half worth of material for it. But I sat down and I got through 15 minutes of it, and the light went out, and I felt pretty good about it, that I'd sort of gotten the upper Midwest up to speed, you know, on the world around us. And I didn't find out for a long time after that, none of us found out, that we had transmitter problems, and we had no audience. We only imagined that we did. So that was my debut in broadcasting, was working very hard on a 15-minute newscast that I delivered with great conviction to the engineer who was on the other side of the window. I had an audience of one, and I'm not sure I had him for the whole 15 minutes. I think some of his friends came in to the control room during my maiden newscast, and I think that he turned the monitors off. I can't be sure of that.
What was it like for you the very first time you heard your own voice recorded and played back?
You know, I thought it didn't sound that bad, really. I had been listening to newscasters when I was a kid, of course. Cedric Adams was the great newscaster of the Upper Midwest. He used to say that after his 10 o'clock news, Northwest Airline pilots flying over Minnesota could see the lights dim in all the small towns all across Minnesota about 10:15. People turn in after they gotten the news from Cedric. But so I worked on his inflection and, you know, that nice sort of friendly and yet authoritative falling inflection, flat Midwestern voice. And I got it down pretty well. But then I got into educational radio, the forerunner of public radio, and they had all those BBC programs on and corrupted my voice for years. I was trying to sound British. Ever so often, I think I still hear a twinge of it in my voice.
What were you doing then, reading news or announcing classical music?
I was reading news and announcing classical music, and I was doing documentaries. I wrote some radio plays. I got to do an awful lot, most of which I would not care to listen to again.
Were you able to really pronounce all the classical composers' names?
The ones I absolutely could not pronounce, I didn't play. And so their music has passed into obscurity. A lot of French composers I didn't play as often as the German. The German you kind of fake your way through. Who did I have a hard time with? Millot, I guess. Darius Millot. And Jacques Ibert, and I mispronounced them for a while. But once you get it, you know, then you're so proud. You just can't wait for a chance to use Darius Milhaud's name, Eric Satie, and all those guys.
What's the balance now in your life between radio and writing for the page?
Well, radio is radio demands a great deal of attention, 'cause it gets harder the longer you do it, and you keep expecting there to come a time when when humor will just run out and when you'll go on the air and you won't be funny anymore. So I have to keep working at it to keep being silly. And radio writing I do all the times I can't do radio. I wrote a lot of this book in odd places at odd times, and you have to learn how to do that if you're going to keep two little careers on the burner at the same time.
How's New York been treating you?
New York is treating me the same as it treats everybody else. New York does not make distinctions between people. I get by pretty well here. You just have to remember that in New York, the race is not always to the swift, and you have to be prepared to be sort of continually 15 minutes late for everything.
Have you learned to be loud and pushy yet?
I don't think that I have, but maybe people in Minnesota would think that I have. I'm not sure.
Well, seriously, when you go back to Minnesota, I don't know how often you do that, but when you do you find that your sense of speed or the volume at which you speak has changed?
I get much more irritated if things go wrong, and if the plane is late and the baggage doesn't come, and when you go through all of sort of ordinary little hassles of life, I think that gets steamed more easily. New York rubs a lot of skin off, I think. It's one of the problems of living here is that it kind of tries your patience.
Thanks a lot for talking with us about your new book and for reading from it and everything. And good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. Good luck to you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks, and to you. Garrison Keillor's new novel is WLT, A Radio Romance. Next week, he begins a national tour of readings and book signings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.